Welcome back to the A-Suite Podcast. We are UCLA Anderson MBA students bringing you the best insights on industry deep dives, the MBA experience in general, and so much more. Hey everyone, John Lee here, and today's episode is an absolute treat. And it was a huge moment for our podcast as well. This was our very first episode that was live streamed on Twitch. I was able to sit down with a good friend, Mike Zhang, and talk about his entrepreneurial journey and all of his exits and pursuits as an entrepreneur, as well as now an angel investor. So without further ado, let's get right into the interview. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us on this beautiful Friday morning. We have our boy Mike Zhang in the house. From the ages of 13 to 14, Mike started his very own e-commerce business and grew that out and pursued entrepreneurship and generated over $160 million in revenue. So that's a pretty incredible feat. Since then, he's exited multiple companies as well as start more ventures. And then right now he's working on his newest venture, I believe, called Good Money. Is that correct?
That's right.
Awesome. Awesome. I guess let's start from the very beginning. I know you've probably told this story hundreds of thousands of times already, but can you walk us through your start at the ages of 13 and 14 with Airsoft Megastore and kind of walk us through that initial journey?
Yeah, it's most of the times the starting point for part of the entrepreneurial journey. But as we know, our experiences growing up ultimately shape who we are and a lot of the habits and mental models we carry as adults. So I'll probably start a little earlier than that. I grew up in Beijing. My family is from just outside of Shanghai, China. Mm. And I had this, really interesting upbringing because on the one hand, in the 90s, China was still, very, traditionally closed off, and they were in this process of opening up to the outside world. And I think the WTO like trade deal had just happened, in the early 90s. So it was still super early days in terms of the commercialization and kind of like the economy that you see today. And it was interesting because I sort of got to see a little bit of the best of both worlds, and best is subjective. But the both worlds, I think, rings more true in the sense that you sort of saw this traditionally communist, traditionally insular regime and government really open up selectively to the outside world. And I feel like I sort of didn't even realize it at the time, but I had a front row seat of that. Because my parents both worked in the government. My mom was working at the American Embassy at the time. She was a attaché to one of the diplomats who that sort of worked at the embassy on foreign policy and things like that. And so I remember always kind of being fascinated by American culture because they'd have like holiday parties, and I'd be like, "Whoa, what is Christmas? Like Santa Claus?" Like so, it was like. Is really strange, right? Because you have kind of sort of your caricature of like all American kind of spirit and culture, and then on the other hand, like day-to-day life is still very much Chinese. And I think it was really formative for me to have seen that because I ultimately my family immigrated here to the States. I moved here when I was about 7. And it was a very different experience because if there are any first generation immigrants out there, you don't even have to be one to probably resonate with the story and kind of the patterns of the story, which is you have just a lot of challenges, establishing yourself in this new place with maybe not a lot of family, not a lot of, financial support. So you have to figure it out. It's kind of an entrepreneurial journey in its own right. It's a long-winded way of saying I saw my parents go through a lot, and the kind of driver for why I wanted to start a business again, it's one of those things where in hindsight everything is 2020, but at the time you probably couldn't even explain it. it was, I saw it as a vehicle or a canvas where if I kind of played my cards right, I'd be able to help out, you know, financially. And, you know, so that was kind of part of my interest was like, you know, buying and selling stuff online. eBay was taking off at the time. So that's kind of how I got my start. And then, you know, with the first company, Airsoft, it was a series of fortunate coincidences that led me to start that company at that time, you know, in that industry.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I really appreciate you sharing like the backstory and like the motivations. What goes through the mind of you as a 13, 14 year old to help you see that opportunity? I know you mentioned your family, but would love to hear more of that mindset as you were young Mike.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm gonna step into the time machine. You know, I think you sort of have a mindset that amounts to something like beginner's mind. That's maybe one way to put it. Another way to put it is it's like playing the game like you got nothing to lose. And I think it's such a privileged mental model to adopt, because most of the times if you're playing with that mentality, really the universe kind of works in strange ways such that the circumstances that kind of form around you actually benefit this belief that, well, if I've got nothing to lose, then, you know, inversely, that means I've got everything to gain. That was probably the mindset. Was just kind of like throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall, see what sticks. But I will say, you know, buying and selling stuff online would ultimately turn into my first company, you know, which was an e-commerce venture. The rules are actually fairly straightforward from a, you know, just math perspective. Which is, you know, you buy something for $10 and you try to sell it for, you know, $20 or $40 or $50. Exactly.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. No, I love that. I absolutely love that. And I really enjoy that point of, you know, play the game as if you got nothing to lose. That's such a cool mindset that I feel like I'm trying to use that now because, you know, in business school, there's a lot of risk taking and things of that nature, but I digress. So I also saw that you have many, many different ventures. You've done like Drip Club, you've started to invest, you're working on Good Money. So I'd love to hear your thought process, I guess, on how you tackle new ventures and how you choose to like commit to one versus the other. Would love to hear that because you have a very diverse range of ventures that you've taken on.
Yeah, it's a good question. So probably the thing that drives the decision making the most, if you can even call it that, you know, is just keeping an open mind for the serendipitous things to kind of line up and happen. So it sounds all woo woo and stuff, but I think there is some importance to feeling grounded and kind of opening yourself up to kind of the possibilities without, you know, slamming shut a door that might be open or, you know, trying to force open a door that's not open, just kind of letting the things play out. And more tactically, the first company after I had sold it and kind of stayed on to help the private equity firm transition and, you know, kind of install their management as they typically do, I was 22, you know, I was hungry. I was still super young. And I was like, well, maybe that was a fluke. Maybe I need to do that again just to kind of prove to myself, which wasn't the healthiest thing probably at the time. But, you know, you got a flavor of what it feels like to really win. When a certain part of the game, and so then you sort of inevitably wonder if you actually enjoy playing the game. In this case, the medium just happens to be business, or building a business. you know, you start to ask yourself, well, could I do it again? Could I do it better? What would I be doing differently? What are the things I've learned, and so on and so forth. And so, that was really the thing, is like looking for the next vehicle where I could use the company in the process of building the company to almost codify some of the lessons and learnings, and see if those lessons and learnings were actually true or not. Because sometimes, you know, you go through something, maybe it was a really challenging period in, you know, your first semester of college, or, you know, whatever those kind of watershed moments are usually for people. And you learn stuff. But, you know, with all knowledge and sort of wisdom retention, unless you have the forum and the playing field to continuously like hone and refine that, or even put it into practice, it gets, you know, you get rusty, and, you know, you lose your edge. And so that just talking through some of the things I think that were going through my mind, when, I went from the first company to the second company, which is also kind of a direct-to-consumer or branded consumer, I should say, you know, B2C and B2B slash e-commerce business. And I started that with two of my really close friends. And they had actually started the company before I had joined. So I joined sort of as the third partner CEO, and I wrote a small check into the company, and it was like, it felt, there was this magical chemistry of it feeling like, a startup again, you know, back in the garage, right? You know, that sort of mentality. So, it was a cool experience. And that's what drew me to it, was like the opportunity to kind of not, you know, work for somebody or go do things that someone wants to pay me a bunch of money to do, but like work with friends, and maybe we can get a shot at making something special.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you sharing that. And there's so many points in that I want to dive into, but I guess the most recent point with your, I guess your founding team in classes right now, I'm in an entrepreneurship class, and we're dissecting like what makes a founding team, what makes it successful. And so many times we hear like stay away from family and friends, but I'd love to hear, in your opinion, what makes a strong foundation for a founding team from your beginning ventures and even your current ventures as like the co-founder of Good Money at the moment? So love to hear that, just because it's so relevant to a lot of the students here.
Yeah, there's a lot of academic research on this. So I would really encourage everybody to kind of go look at the academic research and serve as a baseline, right? Because I think with anything, again, through the filter of just business, but I really think in many other aspects of life, but if you just take the filter of looking at it from, you know, how do I use this information to gain an edge in some business venture that I'm running or thinking about starting or joining or whatever the case might be, if it has to do with people, usually there are no rules. There are maybe some principles, maybe there are some rules that come with qualifiers, but I guess I would start with, make sure that you're evaluating the context alongside the application of any rules. So I'll give that, I'll put that into context with an example. I've definitely heard that, you know, no family, no friends. And, you know, I kind of broke that rule, I guess, twice, because the first company, I had no choice. I was 14. My parents were the source of capital, and the source of capital was their life savings at the time. So I convinced them to part ways and let me borrow the life savings. And, you know, I took it seriously, obviously. But and thinking back, it is kind of scary, right? Because
real quick.
If things didn't turn out,
What was that conversation like? Did you like create like a PowerPoint presentation, or were you just like chatting to them? Like, how do you convince your folks, hey, life savings, you know, I can do that to make it better. I could flip that around for even more.
Yeah, you know, I wish I was more deliberate But it's just one of those things where, you know, imagine you're 14 and you see an opportunity, obviously no idea the operational complexities of like managing a business that has to do import and export and, you know, the business licenses, like how do you build out a warehouse and fulfillment center? Like, you know, Amazon third-party fulfillment wasn't around back then, right? So all of these things, but you don't think about it. And that's kind of the beginner's mind, right? It's like you have to kind of be crazy enough to think it'll actually work, but grounded enough to know that like, well, why is it that I think that? Not just because I want it to work, but because, you know, I have somewhat of a thesis on this. And the thesis, going back to the math part of it, was I was seeing products that I knew how to source or where to source them from. You know, that you could buy for $5 or $10 and you can sell reliably for $50 to $70, let's just say, right? And so to me, it seemed like a no-brainer. Like, buy it.
Why isn't everyone doing this?
List it. Yeah, exactly. Of course, you know, they had their reservations, and that's putting it very mildly, my folks. but they came around to it because I just started out of a kind of a playful frustration. I started printing out all of the listings of products that had sold that day. Cause you know, you can go into eBay, for instance, and search for all the things that sold. And that's where we got our start on the marketplaces. And, you know, I'd sit and tally up like, you know, this many things sold. So this is like $5,000 of sales. And it would have only cost us, you know, $1,000. Why are we waiting another day? Let's go do this. So that was the mentality. Dinner conversation for a couple of months, and they caved.
That's amazing. No, I absolutely love that. Absolutely love that. And can we go back to, I guess, your thoughts on the founding team? Apologize. I just thought that was such a interesting piece of your story that people would like to hear.
So I think, founding team, I mean, it's really about what you're trying to optimize for. I think there are no rules that are categorically true or categorically false or invalid. So it's really just about the application context of any of these sort of truisms, if you want to call them that. So what you get with friends, what you get with family, depends on your relationship with these friends, but let's assume this is like best friend, very trustworthy, values aligned, and you sort of, you're generally, your natural disposition is you're on the same page with this person or these people, right? So let's say that's the case. What you get with that is trust and security. And you might also get a degree of not just having the canvas to share the wins, but to really work through the losses together, which is really important. That's a lonely kind of part of the journey that, you know, people don't really talk about, but is evident and exists if you want to do something really great. You know, I think it's just part of that iterative process.
Yeah, of course.
So that's what you get. I think there's trust, there's kind of this solid foundation, this base of like, you know, being able to really, you know, go out there and like conquer the world, right? That's sort of on the upside. Now, the drawbacks to that, I think, are if, and I'm gonna make some examples here. So these are not rules, but these are just kind of qualifiers for the context of this comment. The downsides are, you probably look at if you're entering something that is a business or an industry that is very sort of knowledge qualified or expertise specific, you know, so you need an expert's knowledge to be able to start, you know, a highly technical company. And so no matter how good of friends you are with somebody, if they're not that co-founder that's bringing, you know, one set of expertise that you have determined is required to make this a successful, you know, company, then you know, it doesn't mean there's not a role for them. It just means you have to be really careful what expectations are for, you know, the contribution of, you know, that person or that family member, you know, relative to what you need them to do in order for the company to be successful. So, so that's an example of potential hazards of, you know, having somebody, family member or close friends, part of the founding team.
I mean, I really appreciate the idea of trust. And I think in our classes, we definitely talk a lot about trust and making sure you're aligned on the vision, and that having such a crucial part to actually having a team. Without that vision, without that alignment or that trust, things just slowly start to crumble. And so I really appreciate your emphasis on that. It's cool to hear that our classes are saying similar things to what you're saying. I guess kind of shifting gears a little bit, I've always just been curious, like, you've exited several companies before, and that is an entire process on its own. But I'd love to hear, like, business-wise, how do you evaluate, or what type of metrics are you looking at to know when you should exit? And then also a second part to that is, like, personally, how do you evaluate yourself on, you know, maybe it's time I move on. Maybe this is getting a little too stagnant and I need to have a shift. So I'd love to hear that thought process of the business perspective as well as your own personal perspective.
Yeah. The business perspective, I mean, I'll name some maybe common drivers, and then I'll say this is not an exhaustive list, but, you know, stage of business. If it's a business that is maturing in an industry that's stagnant, or an industry that's maturing, you know, at a certain point, you sort of look at the capitalization of the business and you say, okay, well, you know, family owned, probably could, very conservative, you know, no debt on the balance sheet, could maybe benefit from putting a little debt on the business. And, you know, I don't, as family owners, I don't want to be necessarily around, you know, for to take that risk and to go generate that return on that risk. So that's, you know, I would say, it fits somewhat of the profile of the first company that I started and it ended up selling 8 years later. So you know, other kind of business drivers, I mean, there's so many, but a lot of times, maybe one relevant kind of track that we can talk through is venture and sort of venture backed investments. So you think about your prototypical technology startup, right? And I mean, you could read about most of these things in you know, in the news, or tons of people blog about it. But it's a lot of it has to do with, I think, what the purpose or the intent of the controlling shareholders are. So, you know, if you've kind of got the conviction to build like a 20 or 30, you know, multi-decade enduring enterprise, your exit sort of parameters might be simple. We don't want to exit ever. Like, we want to basically build, you know, this decades long growth streak, right? So there are plenty of companies that do that. On the flip side of that, you know, there are folks who can basically take, you know, a business as, and they treat it no more or no less than, you know, just a game that they want to play, and winning the game to them means, you know, getting an exit. And that's totally fine. But I think to your point, it's like even the step before, oh, the co-founders are aligned on the vision and there's trust in that. I think it's really important to look deep inside of yourself, which, if you've ever tried it, is actually really hard to do. Like, what do I want? Yeah. What do I want for myself? What do I want for myself in 10 years? It's hard to answer that question, right? 100%. But a lot of times, you know, if you don't answer it and you're not sure and you haven't even tried to, just scratch at that a little bit and see what, you know, comes off of it. What ends up happening is you're not in the driver's seat when you find out. something is happening to you that triggers you to find out. And then, you know, you wake up one day and you're like, whoa, wait a minute. Have I devoted 5 years of my life to, you know, building something or being a part of something that I fundamentally, you know, have come to realize does not suit me anymore? So, you know, maybe a nice segue into kind of the personal reasons of why you would exit or start or kind of, you know, just join a company at really at any stage of the life cycle. But I guess most relevant here would be the early stage is just try. I would not underestimate the value of digging deep and really being contemplative about and trying to figure out what are some of the real reasons and give those reasons the space without judgment to manifest, right? So, you know, if it's like, hey, I just really don't feel like working for somebody. I know myself enough to know I don't take directions very well.
Right.
And for that reason, I want to start a company. I want it to be as little time of mine as possible because I actually want to go wake up every morning and go surf for 2 hours and not have to worry about, you know, showing up to work or whatever the case might be. And at the end of it, I just hope I can collect a fat paycheck, you know, pay myself a big dividend, and it's a really asset light business. And yet I think if that is true, I would bet that a lot of people would have a hard time saying that that's actually what they want.
Yeah.
100%. And that will prevent you from, you know, really going out there and achieving that because of some, you know, norm or a convention or some other thing that's out there that really has little to no impact substantively on why you should or shouldn't do something, but yet, you know, subconsciously does influence it big time. So.
Yeah. Love that. Love that. Just like really being honest with yourself, not judging yourself based on arbitrary thoughts that you may have or may think that others have. I absolutely love that. And I've definitely been struggling with that. So that's super interesting. I'd love to hear more of like so far, like you just seem like the entrepreneur going at it, going all in, no fear, going at it. Would love to hear your relationship with fear, potentially failure, but how do you combat fear? Has there been fear with these ventures, and what is your process of like tackling it in like a consistent way where you can actually thrive when faced with fear as opposed to shying away from it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's an important question. It's a question that I hope I will be continuously answering and improve my answer over the course of, you know, hopefully a life well lived. I think fear is a really interesting energy to kind of understand and kind of work with. So, you know, it's like on the other side of the fear, a lot of times is the courage to kind of play the game in that original state we were talking about, which is with nothing to lose, like regardless of whether that's true or not, right? And I think in terms of the fear, your relationship to it evolves, and you have to try and pick up on that and then find the way to relate to it that is most useful. Because I think with all emotions, there's kind of a utility to feeling a certain way. So to kind of put that in context, for the first like 4 years, right, of my first company, Airsoft, my relationship with fear was very visceral. It was like every day was one wrong move. In the back of my mind, I knew this. I tried not to think about it, but one wrong move, like, you know, it could be something as silly as, oh, you forgot to put these stickers on this, you know, shipping container's worth of product. And there goes, you know, last year's profits, you know, like something as dire as that, right? Yeah. Where you're just instantly like, you're like, oh, I thought I was doing fine, but how am I basically hanging off the edge of a cliff right now? That happened quickly. And so there, I think the utility of fear is to constantly be looking around the corner, you know, in whatever way that might serve you. So, hey, how could we, you know, not expect things to go swimmingly well? And how can we be anticipatory of issues, you know, be they strategic issues, you know, macro market issues or just operational issues, whatever the case might be. You know, and then when that, like, I mean, I always think about it like moving up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And as the kind of, you're kind of further and further up, the fear then becomes, oh, what if I, I don't know, it's harder to say things. I'm trying to say things that are, that maybe people can relate to. maybe it's like, what if I don't fully fulfill my destiny to be, you know, X, Y, or Z thing, like what that I'm, you know, place that I want to be later in life. Yeah. Okay. So in that relationship, I found it really useful to kind of try and examine what that end state is and then work backwards to how not only fear, but also other kind of emotions that drive our disposition and the, you know, the decisions we make every single day.
Yeah.
How are they playing maybe a hidden influence in the way that we're showing up and, you know, trying to get to where we want to go.
Yeah.
So not to get too philosophical or anything, but it is important. It's an important question, I think, to sort of answer and if nothing else, try to almost document your own relationship with these types of things that, you know, are like subconsciously driving, you know, your life. So got to get a handle on them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I know that was a different turn for sure, but I do think, like you said, it's something important to think about, talk about, and evaluate in yourself, especially whether you're not, you're an entrepreneur in any aspect of life. So I appreciate you kind of taking that leap. Now, I guess tying it back to more business related things, right now, as I understand, you're also an angel investor. And so you're looking at companies trying to figure out where you want to invest your time, your money, your expertise in, and things of that nature. So I know there's a lot of students in my class and the class above me that are looking at startups, trying to start their own companies, looking for investors. Would love to hear your perspective now that you're on the other end of things that you wish you kind of did before when you were looking for investors, as well as an angel investor, what are you looking for specifically in companies before you actually take that leap of faith into providing some capital or expertise for them?
Yeah. So I'll start with the just the angel investing part. I take a pretty intuitive kind of approach to investing, and you know, it's worked out for me. So it doesn't mean that I think there are plenty of amazing funds out there that do a great job. And I've allocated some of my own capital because, you know, I know that you look at an early stage venture fund, right? So I'll take one that's here that's been a huge supporter of the LA ecosystem, Fika Ventures. You take a look at Fika and they've been really, really successful. And I think one of the things being, you know, an LP of the fund that I've come to appreciate is just how surgical they are with their diligence process and their diligence funnel, right? Any number of these funds could be pitched 2,000 times, you know, a year. And they end up writing, you know, depending on the year, maybe 7 to 10, 7 to 12 checks. So as an LP, I feel like it's a really simple question to answer. Can I do that or not? Do I have the time to do that or the expertise or the interest to do that? And you know, I love meeting smart founders who are trying to do something interesting, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I will have any relevant knowledge or experience to share other than maybe a pat on the back and, hey, you know, keep it up and, you know, don't quit type stuff. Right.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I've come to understand that that's not my place. So for my investments, I tend to back people that I've come to know, come to enjoy spending time with, or who I think have sort of a obvious edge in whatever it is that they're going to go and do. So what do I mean by obvious edge? Somebody that has started a company before and in a perfect world has exited it. So they've gone through the cycles, they've put in the reps, and they're coming back for more because they're sickos or whatever the case might be. Or they just have a lot of industry experience that they couldn't quite manifest into the last company, maybe as a result of the last company that they had done. And, you know, they're now going to go paint their masterpiece. And I want to get in on that company, you know, before they go raise a single dime of institutional money. You know, things like that are what drive my personal kind of investing. I also like to invest in industries that I feel like I have a lot of learning I can do. Example is there is a company that I wrote a small check into called Umbra Labs. And what they do is they've taken like 3D printing and sort of this modern API first approach to building a satellite imaging company. And then they've wrapped all of that up in a satellite that costs, you know, a fraction, tiny fraction of what the defense contractors charge. And the, once they launch it into orbit, you know, as a hedge fund analyst, you could buy a subscription or you can basically buy a license and just like look up, you know, that factory with the parking lot. And you're like, hey, I want to know how many cars come in and out of here, because that's going to be a proxy for like next quarter's earnings or whatever they do now. Great. It's $1,000, you know, charge your corporate card and off you go with your high res image. And by the way, it's like better than like Airbus or any of the imaging like Northrop, you know, any of the imaging players. So that was a fascinating company to learn about. If nothing else, just like stay in the loop, right, on, on what they're doing. And I also tend to look for companies where, and this is maybe my own personal investing philosophy, is I look for asymmetrical, like fan of outcomes in terms of risk relative to return. So, you know, there are profiles where you kind of sort of have a good decent idea that something is going to be profitable or commercially viable and ultimately commercially successful. But it's not going to be like, you know, 100x, right? So in the world of you're deploying capital, you know, you're deploying, you're going in capital is always 1x, right? It's 1x of whatever, you know, amount, $100,000, $200,000, right? So 1x. And then you're thinking, you know, okay, this is a relatively safe investment. And over the course of 7 years, it's going to be 3x. And those are interesting. I do a lot of that stuff in real estate. but the most interesting things to me are where it's like, I'm expecting it to be 0x. But if it works, it's going to be 1,000 or 2,000x. So those, you know, they come along far fewer and more infrequent than the pitch decks would suggest. But when you find one, it's a really good feeling, because usually the founders are doing something really interesting and the founders themselves usually are very special. So
Yeah, no, I love that. I love love your thoughts on all this. And I recall the first time we met, you mentioned Umbra, and we talked extensively about that, just because I have a background in the space satellite industry.
That's right.
So I love the bringing that back. So like, how do you take a break? Like, what do you do for you? It seems like you have so many different things on your plate. You might have alluded to this beforehand, but I'd love to hear like, how does Mike Zhang relax and, you know, take a break, do something else?
Yeah, you know, I have a range of interests. Not sure there's a theme, but one of the things that I think this past year we've all had to adapt to, you know, working full time from home and not being able to go outside when you want to. So one of the things that I've really found a lot of pleasure in is actually just hanging out, shooting the shit, like, you know, kind of actually being at home and being fully present at home with my wife.
Yeah.
Kelly, so who fun. Is one of your classmates.
Yeah, so, she's the reason this happened. She brought us together. So
that's right.
Shout out to Kelly if she's here.
Shout out to Kelly.
Wherever you are.
Yeah. So we've awesome. Really just adapted and found a lot of play games sometimes, or we'll watch a movie. We've probably watched all of the best TV shows on like HBO and Showtime there are to watch. And yeah, it's just kind of like almost reigniting a little bit of this like ability to stay present and stay without having to be somewhere doing something all the time.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah. Quality time, making quality new memories. Time. And yes. That's amazing. I'm so happy for both of you. okay, so I got some of these questions. So let's just run through it. Maybe we could do like a fire quickly, like quick answers. I guess maybe one to four sentences and see how that works. And if you want to dive more into one or the other, you can. But the first question we have here, this is interesting. How do you get in the zone where you're motivated, no distractions, full on improvement, happiness, efficiency? How does Mike Zhang get into that zone? Or do you have a zone?
Yes. Well, it sounds rather elementary, but I just block out large blocks on my calendar. And I don't force it. I really don't force it. And meditation helps. So I don't meditate specifically for any benefits, but I just find, I should say, breathing exercises in general really help you slow down the heart rate, kind of just be okay with things not being okay. And then from that state of mind, you can kind of roll it forward. But focus is really important.
So, I love that. I remember I interviewed this chef, and her whole mantra was like, your breath is your peace. And she really appreciated like controlling your breath. Yeah. And that's how she got through the tough days, the great days, and every day. So resonates super hard. So appreciate that. This one says, what are some tips you can give to people that are trying to make a business? I feel like this whole conversation was about that, but I guess if you could wrap, like, let's say three tips that you can give.
Start. No regrets. You're going to be learning something, and don't give up.
Amen. Oof, love it. All right. How hard was it to get investors for your project? And what was the hardest part of that process?
So it's a process. And I think it really, there are kind of some qualitative drivers. So there's obviously like, what are you doing? How big is the market size? What's your track record? Things like that. And then in the absence of like, what's your track record, it's how is the company actually doing, right? And so those are all things that sort of will drive that. But I think there's this myth of like every successful company, just like piece of cake, phones it in and raises whatever money they want. And that might be true maybe 5% of the time, but I feel like most of the time it's a grind, like good money. We raised a $30 million Series A a couple years ago, and it's been really admiring to watch my partner and co-CEO go to work. I mean, it was like, for fundraising, it was 6 in the morning to probably 9 or 10 at night, five days a week. And then on the weekends, he's sort of teeing up the next week. And I've just had so much appreciation and respect for Gunnar, my partner, in sort of the way that he's handled that and allowed me to kind of execute the strategy and sort of parachute in at the times that are necessary, in the fundraising process when we want to go do a product deep dive or a strategy deep dive. Whatever the case might be. I guess I don't know if that answers the question, but I would say it's different depending on the context and the stage of the business. Gunnar obviously founded a company called Thrive Market that's raised, you know, almost $500 million of capital. So it was probably a little easier for him. But
yeah,
I use that as a story because even so, this is a guy that's still, you know, hauling ass to make it happen. So it's not easy, and you shouldn't expect everybody to love your idea. And there are plenty of companies that we all probably use, interact with today that have become, you know, quote, successful that got rejected by like every single venture fund, you know, there is, and they had to kind of scrape it together somehow. So going back to the original comment of step three, which is don't give up.
Amen. No, I love that. And I think it's so important that you highlighted the behind the scenes, like what actually goes on to make those investments happen, because it's very common to just see the headlines, right? Like you just see the headlines of, oh, this person or this team, this company just raised, you know, like you said, $500 million, $200 million, $10 million. And it just seems so easy. And I feel like a lot of talk that I've listened to for ventures, it's like there's so much money in the space that people are just giving money away just to like invest in something. But there is still a lot that goes on behind the scenes. So I love that you highlighted that. And all right, so next question, what is a startup that you wanted to do but couldn't for whatever reason, if any?
I mean, assuming you're Anderson students, you could go ask Kelly about the about the million and one startups that I'm like just constantly beaming to her. She's like, shut up. You just have to throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall. So I'm not sure I could say there's one startup that I wish I could do, but I couldn't do. But in general, I would say all things point back towards solving some of the larger social issues. And it doesn't mean like day one, your like company is about like, you know, solving the world's problems. But so long as you can kind of, you know, just trace how it might be related. So for instance, like I think the power of building a banking platform in the financial services industry right now is, you know, it's up there in terms of GDP impact with healthcare as like, you know, the number one or number two, a multi-trillion dollar industry. And if you kind of look under the hood, there's a lot of like mainframe computers and, you know, stuff from like way back when, ripe for disruption. And from a socioeconomic perspective, you have this crazy, insane like division between the haves and the have-nots with an increasing kind of size and set of issues for the have-nots. And I think it's incredibly exciting to be able to kind of think about what is the power of, you know, combining technology and access to financial services in a way that is no longer, say, exploitative or, you know, only serving the interests of the corporation, right? So sort of, you know, in the classic strategy sense, like giving more of that value capture and leaving it on the table while driving up willingness to pay and not capturing all that value up front, because you actually have, you know, the interest of the customer in mind. And I think those are the types of companies that are going to be successful in fintech. So hopefully that's helpful in terms of framing the, you know, what to build and how to think about it.
Yeah, of course. And this is a great segue into, I wanted to end on, like, let's hear about your venture. You kind of talked a little bit of the pieces of it just now, but for a lot of people, at least in the chat right now, I don't think that they fully grasp what you're building. So let's talk about you, your current venture, your company, and your hopes for it, and where people can find you in order to stay connected and keep up with your newest ventures.
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. I don't have a TikTok, unfortunately. And yeah, LinkedIn is great. So Good Money is a digital banking platform. That's what I'm working on now. I've been at Good Money for, and working on Good Money for maybe a year and a half, almost 2 years. And we're actually going to market. We launched a beta, learned a lot of things from our users. It is really, you know, as much as the technology has improved, it is really hard to build in fintech and build it the right way. Because if you think about what goes into launching a bank account that's accessible through your phone and a debit card that's linked to that, never mind the features and cool stuff, you're automatically sort of under the regulatory regime of the FDIC, the OCC, the CFPB, like all of these regulatory agencies that exist to make sure that banks are not, you know, exploiting people.
Right.
So it's basically like, you know, building a bank from scratch. And that is, you know, both a tremendous challenge, set of challenges, and also an even, I think, greater set of opportunities. So we learned a lot from the beta that we launched for, we launched a debit card program in the middle, I think summer, late summer of last year, 2020. And we're taking a lot of that feedback and retooling the product vision and narrowing the use case and sort of the target customer. So I won't give away too much, but I'll probably have more to report on it in the next 6 to 9 months when we actually do our go-to-market. But it's a really interesting play on how to take everyday habits, you know, spend habits, and help consumers, particularly millennial consumers, sort of our age group, with feeling like they are participating in an inclusive financial system that accounts for the the interests of the planet, and you know, by not putting any dollars on the balance sheet as many big banks do, you know, into fossil fuels and extractive capitalism broadly, and also accelerating the path towards financial independence and financial freedom. So that's the kind of, you know, fun part, and more to come there.
Yeah. Amen. No, thank you so much for sharing that. That's such a cool venture, and you know, you got to have big ideas, and that's definitely a big idea. And I love that you're just taking it, running with it, and I guess following your own advice and like not giving up, continuously pushing forward. I can't wait to see where that is 6 to 9 months. Maybe we'll have you back on, and then you can give us an update.
I'd love that. I'll do the pitch then.
Yeah. That'd be awesome. That'd be so cool. Yeah, well, you know, thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy man, so I really appreciate you being out here, sharing your story. Is there any last minute thing you'd like to say to the audience that's listening here right now?
Just, you know, stay hopeful. It's kind of an interesting period of history, uncharted waters that we're going through. So, you know, I just want to create some space for people to kind of be okay with feeling like it's not okay. I think there's just so much going on politically that, you know, sometimes you just got to give yourself the permission to slow down a little bit. You know, you can't build a successful venture when you show up at the starting line and you're like 40%, you know, running low on gas, right? So these are the moments where, you know, you can either sort of stubbornly push through or give yourself a little bit of like take a step back so you can take 10 steps forward. So Yeah.
Awesome. Give it up for Mike Zhang, everybody. What a legend. Now, as an aspiring entrepreneur myself, I really connected with a lot of points Mike made today, but the most important one was made near the end. I encourage you all to work on being okay with not being okay. I resonate a lot with Mike's advice to slow down a bit and refine myself when things around me just seem to be collapsing. Give yourself the best chance and start your journey at 100%. I cannot wait to hear about all the entrepreneurial endeavors you are all deciding to pursue. Now, once again, big shout out to our guest, Mike Zhang, for coming on and sharing his knowledge about entrepreneurship, starting a company, selling it, investing, and just following his passions. As mentioned, you can find Mike Zhang on LinkedIn. Feel free to connect with him, shoot him a message. Now, if you enjoyed this episode or if something resonated with you, tell us about it. Send us an email at theasuitepodcast@gmail.com. Better yet, leave us a review on your favorite podcast app and tell your friends all about the A-Suite. Now, as always, I wanted to give a few thank yous. One thank you goes out to our executive audio director, Alyssa. One goes out to our executive producer, Jody. And one goes to your host, yours truly. Thank you all so much for listening today, and we'll see you next time on the A-Suite Podcast. Signing off.